Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Seven years ago in Brooklyn, New York, the performance artist known as Death Bear was making the rounds. His mission? Helping the brokenhearted. In this week's essay, Lauren Berlin writes about what it was like to invite Death Bear into her friend's home. Rye Russo-Young, director of the film Before I Fall, reads us Lauren's essay, Death Bear Will See You Now.
Sunday morning, we sat at Diana's dinette table in Park Slope, Brooklyn, waiting for Death Bear. We considered making him breakfast, but decided not to, thinking he would probably just come in, take the stuff, and leave. We waited. "You think he'll talk to us?" I asked. "It said in the email that he will talk, but that he will only speak to you as Death Bear." We waited some more. Then Diana received the text message announcing his arrival. "He's downstairs!" she shrieked. "Death Bear is downstairs! Oh my God!" She leaped up and rushed down the steps. I followed her out and stood at the top of the stairwell watching. It was January. The eastern seaboard was recovering from a storm. Patches of ice lurked on the sidewalks, and the street curbs were ridged in mounds of dirty, plowed snow. I'd come to New York for the weekend to see Diana, one of my best friends from college. She had broken up with her boyfriend of 5 years and was having a difficult time. I was there to cheer her up. The Friday night I arrived, we ate bowls of chickpea stew and slabs of her mother's tart lemon cake. We put on our pajamas, opened a bottle of wine, and curled up on the sofa to chat. "Oh, I got this email I wanted to show you," Diana exclaimed, leaping up to grab her laptop. It was from The Skim, a popular newsletter. It read, "Someone's knocking at your door in a 7-foot-tall bear suit. Summoned via text message, Death Bear will visit your Brooklyn apartment to remove painful reminders of your past and give you the chance to start fresh. The resolution service is free this Saturday and Sunday." It provided a phone number to text and make an appointment, as well as websites to learn more about the performance artist who had created Death Bear. We decided to do it. Diana texted him to request a Saturday appointment. He promptly replied that he was already booked for Saturday, but he asked if we would be willing to wait for his visit during a 4-hour window on Sunday, as if he were the cable guy. Finally, he agreed to a 9 a.m. visit, which he later rescheduled for 10. On Saturday, Diana hauled out a cardboard box and began surveying her apartment for items for Death Bear. Her ex had taken most of his stuff when he'd moved. The framed poster of his favorite movie was gone, as were a series of prints above the sofa, leaving silver hooks on the walls. He'd taken his clothes and music collection. But so much still remained, tucked away everywhere, like Easter eggs. There was the green artichoke-shaped candle her mother had given him. A piece of white plastic shaped like a robot that he'd hung on her keychain. The Mr. T postcard he'd sent her that read, "You dumb Anne," in shiny gold letters. An expensive brown corduroy blazer accidentally left behind. The maroon camping vest he'd given Diana one Christmas, which she decided to keep, arguing that practicality outweighed sentimentality on this specific item. The iPod he'd bought her and engraved with the phrase "Diana's anti-stress machine" for her long subway commutes. His ratty red backpack. And the 4 costumed rubber ducks he'd bought as a joke to line the back of their toilet. Diana threw most of this into the box for Death Bear. Next, she pulled out the top drawer from her dresser, dumping its contents on the ground. She sat cross-legged on the floor, surrounded by the scattered letters, cards, and photos. She must have gathered them in the drawer after the breakup and hadn't looked at them until now. She shuffled through the papers, stopping at a photo of her ex. Her eyes filled with tears, her face flushed. She gulped and sniffled again. Then she began to cry. I joined her on the floor, rested my face on her shoulder and rubbed her back, feeling her ribs rise and fall with each sob. She shoved the last of the letters into the cardboard box. That evening, we ate pasta and oysters at a neighborhood Italian restaurant and wondered aloud if Death Bear would actually show up. On Sunday morning, as I stood at the top of the stairs watching Diana greet Death Bear, the first thing I noticed about him was that he was thin and delicate, with the lithe frame of a boy who was never large enough for a high school sports team. He wore flimsy black pants, a long-sleeved black shirt that looked as if it had been bought on sale at a discount retailer, and black lace-up leather boots that were popular among grungy teenagers. He had a massive, bulbous black bear mask that engulfed his head and his entire neck. The mask's cheeks were round and bulging. The effect was a creepy, bear-like animal that simultaneously recalled a child's cartoon character and the Grim Reaper, as if Tim Burton had decided Beetlejuice needed a sidekick. I watched Death Bear as he gingerly slid a foot first up one step and then up another, while lightly resting his hand on the weathered banister. He seemed tentative, almost shy. "Is this okay?" Diana asked. "Can you see?" She stood beside him with her hands in the air like a parent spotting a child who was learning to ride a bike.
"This is fine,"
he replied, his voice muffled by the giant bear head.
"I can do steps."
He rounded the top of the stairwell and entered Diana's apartment. "So," Diana began awkwardly, "thank you for coming, Death Bear." She sounded both amused and unsure of herself.
"You're welcome,"
he replied as he put down a large black duffel bag. There was a moment of silence, and then more silence. He turned to study the room, like an exterminator searching for signs of vermin, and I wondered if he noticed the empty silver hooks on the otherwise blank walls where Diana's ex's pictures had hung. Death Bear faced Diana.
"What do you need me to do?"
His voice was kind and distant. "Well, I have some stuff I need to get rid of," Diana said. She didn't mention the breakup. "I don't know how much stuff you can take." He showed her the bag and explained that he could take whatever fit in it. They decided that meant everything but the plastic Viking helmet and the backpack. "Great," Diana said. She sat down next to the box of stuff she had collected and began to pull out items and hand them to Death Bear. The artichoke candle, the corduroy blazer, an old cell phone full of text messages from her ex. Death Bear accepted the items and gently placed them into his bag. He moved deliberately and with care, as if he was preparing to ship them far away and knew they needed to arrive safely. Soon, it was time to give him the letters. Death Bear stood silent, facing Diana, his palms outstretched. He had smooth hands that looked as if they weren't done growing, and his wrists, which were just barely visible beneath the cuffs of his black shirt, were slim and square, unusually angular with protruding bones. His skin was the color of milky hot chocolate and hairless. Diana paused, looking at the pile of papers, the cards celebrating anniversaries, the photos from their travels abroad, and the sentimental notes. Wordlessly, she handed the stack to Death Bear. And then she began to cry. I did not go to comfort Diana. Instead, I remained seated at the tiny dinette table where I had been since Death Bear's arrival. I watched in silence as Diana cried and Death Bear tucked the letters into his duffel bag. She looked up at him, tears streaming down her face. He was bent over his bag, rearranging items. Finally, Death Bear zipped the duffel bag closed and stood to face Diana.
I hope that I'm helpful to you in some way.
She smiled back, unable to speak, and no one said anything. As I watched Diana and Death Bear, I felt proud of her for being so brave. Maybe it was bizarre to invite a complete stranger dressed as a psychedelic animal into your house to remove your most intimate possessions. Then again, maybe it wasn't. Maybe we all have moments where we need such a stranger. Someone whose anonymity allows us to let down our guard and show our raw and battered hearts, to reveal the mess we know ourselves to be. Maybe Death Bear provides a public service by wiping the slate clean when we are too exhausted to pick up the rag and do it ourselves, and then yet again by disappearing so that we can resume our normal lives. Diana pulled herself together enough that she could now speak. What do you do with the stuff that you collect?
It goes in my cave.
Are you going to do an art installation with it? You should.
No. I think there are a lot of people who would feel uncomfortable seeing their stuff on display.
Huh, she said. I guess. There was silence. Then Death Bear spoke.
I should be going.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming, Death Bear.
You're welcome.
Diana opened the door and watched as Death Bear headed towards the stairs. Thanks again, she said. He turned at the stairwell, the black duffel bag stuffed and hanging from his shoulder. And then he was gone.
Rye Russo Young, reading Lauren Berlin's piece, Death Bear Will See You Now. Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says this piece was a bit of an oddity for the column.
It was a sweet, moving story. I think a lot of the reaction, I know my own reaction, was how it's strange, but you get used to that. And then it becomes very moving when she's handing these things over and handing over letters and handing over these things that have such emotional power. It's sort of all the more remarkable that that emotion and that sort of tenderness can overcome this bizarre scene. And in a way, the death bear becomes sort of invisible by the end. It's really just about a breakup and a catharsis.
A different kind of essay deserves a different kind of conversation. Lauren Berlin and her friend Diana have a lot to say. More in a minute.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When we reached out to Lauren Berlin, we asked her if Diana had recovered from the breakup. She told us we should ask Diana herself. So we did. Lauren joined us from Evanston, Illinois, and Diana from New York City. And from the moment we all connected, we couldn't help but notice that despite the years and the distance, these two share a really tight friendship.
Dee, we have to I feel like we should have, like, a listening party or something somehow.
All right,
sure. Or we have to agree to, like, listen to it at the same time.
We started by asking Lauren what she remembers about the experience.
I remember thinking this is so out of character for me. You know, I'm from Oklahoma, and all I ever want to do is go to bed early and, like, eat broccoli because it's good for you. And suddenly there was this, we're going to let this stranger into my best friend's apartment and let her take all this stuff. And I remember part of me felt like I had no business being there. Like, I felt like I was watching this incredibly intimate moment that in some ways I wanted Diana to get to have alone. And I felt really bad that I was there. And the other part of me felt really, really glad to be there so that she didn't have to have this experience alone. Another thing I really remember about the experience, and Diana, I've never told you this, but I've thought of it a million times, is that some of the things Diana chose to give to Death Bear in my head, I was like, no, I want that. Like,
really?
You gave him an iPod, and there were just some things like that. I really remember that because I still feel like it was such a like selfish thing to be thinking in the midst of this really significant moment.
After all, it really was a difficult time for Diana. So how did she feel about her best friend writing a modern love essay about it?
I'm a pretty reserved, private person, so I think it did kind of catch me off guard a little bit. But I thought it would be a good part of the process of kind of moving on from this relationship, too. So it was that for me as well.
Yeah, I remember being like, before I contacted you, I remember thinking in my head, okay, I love her. If she says it's not okay for this to run, that's going to be okay.
While all breakups are hard, it turns out that Diana's breakup is basically the definition of why truth is stranger than fiction. Diana and her boyfriend were together for almost 6 years.
You know, we lived together and, you know, in my mind, I had thought that that was going to be it, that we were going to be together forever. And sort of towards the end of our relationship, things were really deteriorating, and it was just clear that this relationship had really gone sour. And one day, I got a phone call from a woman, and she said, "I don't know why your phone number keeps popping up in my boyfriend of the last 2.5 years phone." And I called her back and I said, "I don't understand what you're talking about, your boyfriend of the last 2.5 years. And she said, "Yeah, I mean, he's my boyfriend." And I was pretty startled. And then we just kind of broke down that, you know, what had been going on. And, it turned out that she said, "I've been in your apartment like 40 times. And I said, "What are you talking about? I mean, I live here. All of my stuff is here." And she said, "Yes, but he told me that you all had broken up, but that you were suicidal. And so you wouldn't move any of your stuff out. And he didn't want to push it." You know, then in retrospect, I remembered weird things about coming back to my apartment and like all of my mail was stuffed in my underwear drawer. And I was like, what's my mail doing in here? And he was like, "Oh, I was just cleaning up and straightening up and I just kind of threw it in there." And so there were all these kind of little things in retrospect that, you know, maybe I should have picked up on, but that at the time they just sort of seemed justifiable. You know, there were so many things. Her mother had died a couple months ago and he was at the funeral and we figured out that he was calling me from her mom's funeral.
Well, after that, Diana decided to confront her former boyfriend.
And I said, you know, I spoke to her and I know everything and I never want to hear from you ever again. And I hung up the phone and I've never heard from him ever again.
Do your parents know, Dee? Like, I know your sister knows, but do your...
No. Yeah. I'm a little nervous about them listening.
I know,
they
I was just thinking
about it. But, you know, it was 7 years ago, and they know that I'm really happy now, so...
Diana works at Christie's as a specialist in the Latin American art department. She's been in a healthy and happy relationship for just over 3 years. As for Lauren, she's married and says life is less adventurous these days.
I think we do a lot of cool things, but I think our lives are pretty mundane in a lot of respects, in a good way. Like the type of stability and boredom that kind of means everyone's okay in your life, you know?
I think we were also at a different place in our lives when Death Bear came over. I mean, Lauren has a baby and a small child. I mean, so there's not a lot of Death Bear visits now.
That was Diana Branham and Lauren Berlin. Lauren wrote this week's essay, "Death Bear Will See You Now." She's a writer and communications consultant and lives with her family in Evanston, Illinois. Diana lives in Connecticut with her long-term partner. Dan Jones has more to say right after the break.
Thank you.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Welcome back. Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says this essay was especially interesting because of its structure.
It's really told by an observer. It's such a strange scene, and the woman who's going through the breakup is so invested in it that it almost benefits from having this neutral observer who can just describe it. Rarely does this happen on the column, but it worked really well in this case.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. We asked Rai Russo-Young about this essay.
I liked the way that this story was a way to process loss. It felt unusual and honest to me, and I think that sometimes experiences can be cathartic where you least expect them. And this performance artist sort of strange ritual seemed unexpectedly effective to cope with loss. And I think it's nice to look for catharsis in unusual places.
Thanks again to Rai Russo-Young. She's the director of the film Before I Fall, based on the popular young adult novel by Lauren Oliver. It's in theaters now. Next week on the podcast, Laura Dern tells the story of a unique relationship between a priest and a former parishioner.
At 71, Ned was in love with a 28-year-old man, and the church was going nuts. Priests sometimes have to ask hard questions, gently, about our parishioners' lives, but mostly we're called simply to offer them the kind of compassionate presence that we believe defines the holy.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.